Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History of Russia. As usual, I'm Damon, and this is episode 76, Perfidious Albion. Thanks for listening in. Okay, so last time out, we covered, finally, the birth of a new Petrine Romanov heir, young Pavel Petrovich, who was then whisked away by the Empress Elizabeth. We checked in on the latest situation with young Ivan VI up in Kolmogory. And we saw how Catherine, after a period of isolation, depression, and self-reflection, had decided to stop turning the other cheek and stand up for herself, particularly with the Shuvalovs. We said goodbye to Sergei Soltikov, Catherine's ex-lover, but welcome two newcomers into the fold, both of whom would form relationships with the Grand Duchess, Sir Charles Hanbury Williams, platonic, and Count Stanislaus Poniatowski, romantic. And then finally, we witnessed the signing of a new deal between Russia and Great Britain that would hopefully keep Hanover away from Frederick the Great's claws. In this episode, we'll be taking a closer look at the affair between Catherine and Poniatowski, and we'll be checking in on yet another health scare. But, as interesting as those subjects are, we'll be spending the majority of our time getting to grips with some new major developments on the European diplomatic front. Developments that would turn the old established order on its head, and that would come as a nasty surprise for two key individuals. I wonder who they were. But before we get into all of that, just a quick reminder that this podcast is supported by the kind and generous members of the Boyar Duma. If you want to join them to get ad-free content, members-only episodes, early access to general release episodes, and written transcripts for around the price of a cup of coffee a month, then you can by subscribing to the Boyar Duma via Patreon, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. And as always, check the episode notes for the details and links. And just before we get started, I'd like to do a quick shout out to two guys, Sal and Andrew from New Jersey in the US, who interviewed me recently for their brilliant podcast, We the Patriots. I waxed lyrical and sometimes meandered aimlessly. I was actually quite nervous. On various subjects, Putin, Rasputin, the Ukraine war, and NATO, to name but a few. And in the end, I have to say that I found the whole thing to be a really enjoyable experience. As I've said, Sal and Andrew are great guys, and their podcast is a superb place to get some really good insights from an American perspective into what the heck is going on in these frankly rather worrying times. So go on, go and give We the Patriots a listen. Okay, if you're all set, let's flipping well crack on and do some history of Russia. Okay, so it's late 1755, and the somewhat surprising romantic affair between Catherine and Count Stanislaus Poniatowski is in full flow. And I say somewhat surprising, mainly because, for the times, young Stanislaus was not what you would consider to be an ideal lover. As mentioned in the last episode, he didn't have the looks. He was innocent, shy, and sensitive, and perhaps even just a little weak-willed. And before leaving for Russia, he'd been made to promise his mother two things. Number one, he wouldn't drink strong alcohol. And number two, he wouldn't marry before he was 30. And so, taking everything into account, it's difficult to see A, what Catherine saw in him, and B, how the affair actually started. Well, what Catherine saw, or would eventually see, was that Poniatowski was affectionate, charming, discreet, and faithful. And what's more, he loved her for who she was, and not what she was. All that was needed to turn their mutual attraction into a fully-fledged romantic relationship was for someone to take the lead, and this was something that the older and more experienced Catherine was able to do. However, she had to be discreet, which meant that she had to carry on going through the motions, and that of course meant that she still had to spend time with her husband Peter. Now, we don't know if Peter knew about what was going on behind his back, but if he did, he certainly didn't seem too bothered, because his behaviours and activities carried on much as they always had, and a perfect example of this is the incident with the rat. One day in the spring of 1756, Catherine went into Peter's rooms and was shocked to see a large dead rat hanging from a set of model gallows. Peter heard a shriek and rushed into the room to explain that he'd hanged the rat as a war criminal because it had knocked over his toy castle and eaten two of his papier-mâché soldiers. This is the heir to the Russian throne, by the way. Catherine started to laugh, and an embarrassed Peter went off in a huff. Away from this incident, the Crown Prince spent most of his leisure time conducting a series of open dalliances, superb word, with singers, dancers, and most annoyingly for Catherine, a number of her ladies-in-waiting. Now, if Peter's activities were designed to make Catherine jealous, they didn't, and she wasn't. For example, his latest conquest was one of Catherine's ladies, Elizabeth Vorontsova, the niece of Bestuzhev's rival, Mikhail Vorontsov, who, unfortunately, this is Elizabeth, not Mikhail, was not particularly that attractive. She was slightly hunchbacked and her face was pitted with acne scars. But while she had no concerns on the envy front, Catherine was worried that her own activities were perhaps not being kept as secret and discreet as she would have liked. And so she made it crystal clear to both her husband and her ladies-in-waiting that she was not happy with the situation. Peter, as usual, tried to fight back, and he threatened to get the Empress involved. But Catherine, knowing that Elizabeth would be more concerned with Peter's own behaviour, or uninterested, or ill, called his bluff. And in the end he did nothing, let the matter drop, and slunk off to do what he did best, sulk, play with his soldiers, and interfere, mostly unsuccessfully, in the affairs of the Duchy of Holstein. But the path of true love never runs smooth, and Catherine was to find out just how much she loved Poniatowski when in the late summer of 1756 he was recalled to Poland by Augustus III. Now, Stanislaus was no fan of Augustus III, who had succeeded his father Augustus II, or Strong, as King of Poland, Grand Duke of Lithuania, and Elector of Saxony. And Poniatowski's negative views and utterances regarding his lord and master were seen as A, embarrassing, and B, in the light of events that we'll soon get to, pro-Prussian. He was meant to come back to Russia in a matter of weeks, but when he either didn't or couldn't, a frustrated and upset Catherine used Bestuzhev's influence to engineer a speedier return by having him appointed as Poland's official liaison envoy to St. Petersburg. But when he still didn't appear, an increasingly irate Catherine demanded to know why, and Stanislaus was forced to explain that his prolonged absence was in the main, rather embarrassingly, down to his mother. He eventually came back to St. Petersburg in December 1756, and the couple were able to carry on their affair as if nothing had ever happened. And indeed, in the early part of the next year, 1757, there would be, or what some would consider to be, quite a significant turn of events. For the time being, though, we'll leave the young lovers there, and instead we'll cast our eyes and ears back to the Mutual Anglo-Russian Defence Agreement that, if you remember, had been signed back in September 1755 between Bestuzhev and the British ambassador Sir Charles Hanbury Williams, because that did cause, or would help cause, a series of very dramatic developments. As soon as the Prussian king, Frederick the Great, got wind of the deal, and in particular the thought of 50,000 Russian troops on his eastern border, alarm bells started to ring. His next step was to reach out to Great Britain to see what could be done via diplomatic means. But why? What did he think he could achieve? Well, interestingly enough, prior to the Anglo-Russian deal being signed, the British government had tried to negotiate a similar agreement with Prussia. But at that point in time, Frederick hadn't needed Britain's help and had seen no point in taking discussions any further. Now, however, the situation was different. Frederick was a worried man, and Great Britain, seeing Prussia as perhaps the better bet, agreed to Frederick's overtures. Talks opened, and in January 1756, a deal was reached, the net result being that Prussia and Great Britain would come to each other's aid in the event of war, and both parties would seek to maintain the status quo regarding each other's German possessions, i.e. Hanover and Silesia. When news of this new deal reached the French in February 1756, they immediately broke off their alliance with Prussia, and on May the 1st, at the Convention of Versailles, they agreed a new alliance with their traditional enemy, Austria. With political lines redrawn, Frederick struck. In late August, he invaded Saxony to his west with his superbly trained, provisioned, and equipped army, swiftly took both Leipzig and Dresden, and incorporated the Saxon army into his own. Saxony, however, was an Austrian satellite, and so Louis XV of France promised to come to the aid of Maria Theresa of Austria as she sought to push Frederick back. And so, on the European mainland, the series of armed conflicts known as the Seven Years' War had begun. Well, it had actually started prior to Frederick's invasion of Saxony, but we'll get to that in due course. Now, and as I've previously hinted, back in Russia, Bestuzhev was caught completely off guard by these events, and was now, to put it mildly, in something of a quandary. He is, and always has been, anti-French and anti-Prussian, but now that each of these nations is on opposite sides, what is he to do? He does what I would do. He dithers, hoping against hope that something would happen that would make his life and choices easier. In the end, though, Elizabeth made his mind up for him. London tried to convince St. Petersburg that there was nothing in its agreement with Prussia that threatened Russia, but the Empress wasn't buying any of it. She held meetings with the French ambassador, or at least Mikhail Vorontsov did, and in the end, she pledged Russia's aid to her old ally Austria, and got Bestuzhev to tell Hanbury Williams that the Anglo-Russian deal was off. Now, of course, none of this came as a surprise to Sir Charles, as his own government had already told him that behind his back it had signed a deal with the Prussians. But there was to be a sting in the tail, because now London expected their ambassador to remain in St. Petersburg and maintain his relationships with the Russian court, whilst at the same time championing Prussia's interests instead of Russia's. Now, a lesser man, again, i.e. me, would have probably thrown in the towel, perhaps using ill health as an excuse and engineered a face-saving return to London. But Sir Charles was made of sterner stuff, and he swung into action. With the right hand, he told Bestuzhev that despite London's actions, he remained a true ally of Russia, whilst with the left, he made secret contact with the Prussian king, via letters that were sent backwards and forwards via diplomatic pouch, stating that he was willing to be Frederick's eyes and ears in St. Petersburg. Bestuzhev, who was now in a difficult and possibly unstable position himself, decided to trust Hanbury-Williams, as did Frederick, who had no diplomatic or ambassadorial presence in Russia. And so now, Sir Charles Hanbury-Williams was, in effect, playing the role of double agent, picking up pieces of information and gossip via his contacts in St. Petersburg and passing them on to his new friend in Berlin whilst pretending to be sympathetic to Russia. And of course, and as those of you with sharp minds will probably have already twigged, one of Sir Charles's key sources of information was none other than the Grand Duchess Catherine. Okay, I don't know about you, but faced with so much perfidy, I for one need a quick cup of tea and a few moments to gather my thoughts. Okay, I'm back and fully refreshed. Now, Catherine almost certainly did not know of Hanbury-Williams' deception, and she continued to treat him as a valuable friend and confidant, albeit one who in reality was providing her with occasional large amounts of cash for information, which just happened to include news from Catherine's various meetings with the overall commander of the Russian army, Field Marshal Stepan Fyodorovich Apraksin. Apraksin, who incidentally was a relative of Peter the Great's admiral, Fyodor Apraksin, whose palace the Empress Anna Ivanovna had resurrected as the Fourth Winter Palace, had been introduced to Catherine by Bestuzhev, and he, Apraksin that is, had outlined his views on the current state of the Russian army, and they weren't good. Elizabeth had up to this point managed to keep Russia out of the main European conflicts, and subsequently she had paid little attention to the army, which according to Apraksin was now in a parlous state. 15 years of peace had resulted in an overall lack of experience and poor training. Plus, morale was low and supplies and equipment were either antiquated and or in poor condition. Obviously, this news, when it was passed on from Apraksin to Catherine, and then from Catherine to Hanbury-Williams, and finally from Hanbury-Williams to Frederick, allowed the Prussian king to invade Saxony with the knowledge that any interference from Russian forces to his east could probably be handled fairly easily. Catherine was playing a dangerous game here. If Hanbury-Williams' deception along with the cash payments were discovered, then surely her own role in the subterfuge would have disastrous consequences. Luckily, it wasn't, and that was mainly down to two things. Firstly, the current spotlight was on Bestuzhev as he tried to adapt to the new European order and protect his own position. And secondly, Elizabeth, who was now in her mid-40s, was ill again, and this time it looked really serious. No one was sure of the cause. Some said it was epilepsy, others apoplexy, which, and I had to look this up, could have meant either a ruptured blood vessel in the brain or the internal rupture of some other organ. Elizabeth's indisposition, in particular, drew everyone's attention, and again the question on most people's lips was, if she died, who was going to replace her? The Shuvalovs rallied around Peter, whilst Bestuzhev, who was now at least in nominal control of Russia, did a couple of things to further his own and Catherine's positions. Firstly, he set up a war council with himself, naturally, in the chair, and secondly, he drafted and sent to Catherine a secret document which outlined his take on what should happen if Elizabeth died. Peter to become emperor, but as a figurehead only, Catherine to play the role of the effective head of state, but the real power was to be in his own hands. Catherine, somewhat caught off guard and realising the danger that this document would present if it fell into the wrong hands, thanked Bestuzhev for his thoughts, but stated that perhaps his suggestions were a little premature, and then playing for time, she suggested amendments, downplaying her proposed role. Bestuzhev got the message, and for the time being, nothing further was mentioned. It was also around this time that something else of significance happened. The now 15-year-old ex-Tsar Ivan VI was moved from his cell in Kolmogory to a new, more secure cell within the Schlüsselburg fortress, located to the north of St. Petersburg on an island in Lake Ladoga. Now, apparently this was because news of his confinement in Russia's Arctic North was starting to spread. Annoyingly though, we don't know if the move happened prior to or during Elizabeth's period of incapacitation. Probably before, because I doubt that Bestuzhev would have done this off of his own bat. However, due to the seriousness of the Empress's illness and the volatility of the times, it may have been something that Bestuzhev felt was politically expedient and necessary. Okay, we'll pause there briefly. There's an awful lot going on, and so I think it's probably a good time to look at who is doing what and attempt to tie things together in a nice big bundle. Very quickly then. Catherine is having an affair with Poniatowski, while her husband Peter is doing likewise with Elizabeth Vorontsova. Great Britain has snubbed Russia and got into bed with Prussia, and France, Austria and Russia are aligned against them. By the way, the term perfidious Albion, relating to Great Britain's underhand diplomatic behaviour, wouldn't be coined by the French until the revolutionary stroke Napoleonic era. But I think we can all see that well before then, the Brits were up to no good, although it's probably safe to say that they weren't alone in this respect. The British ambassador, Sir Charles Hanbury Williams, is now spying on Russia for London and Berlin, and Catherine and Bestuzhev are unwittingly supplying him with information. The Empress Elizabeth is dangerously ill, Bestuzhev is worried about his future, and Ivan VI has been moved to a new cell. There, that about sums things up. Oh, I nearly forgot, there's also a war on. I mentioned earlier that the Seven Years' War had actually started prior to Frederick the Great's invasion of Saxony, and so we'll spend the rest of this episode looking at how and why this series of conflicts that would be played out in several different geographical locations and that some would later refer to as the First World War had got underway. The initial cause of the war had been the economic and imperial rivalry between Great Britain and France, which had never really gone away and which hadn't been resolved during the wars of either the Spanish or Austrian successions. The actual fighting had started back in 1754 with the advent of the French and Indian War, which saw the British and French North American colonies both trying to assert their supremacy, and initially at least, things did not go well for the 13 colonies and their Native American allies. But it was during the spring of 1756, on the Mediterranean island of Menorca, of all places, that the European phase of the war commenced. Now, Britain had captured the Spanish island of Menorca back in 1708, during the War of the Spanish Succession, and had been officially awarded the island, along with Gibraltar, by the Treaty of Utrecht. But this state of affairs had rankled with the French, and in an attempt to get Spain to join the war on their side, in April they invaded and occupied most of the island. The British sent a force under Admiral John Byng to try to rescue the situation, but after a short naval battle, Byng retreated and the British governor was forced to surrender. Incidentally, Byng would in 1757 be court-martialed and then executed for his part in the proceedings, and, for the time being, Spain would remain neutral. Then, as we've already seen, the key European powers formed themselves into two main blocks, Britain and Prussia versus France, Austria, and later on Russia. In July, Frederick the Great, sensing that Austria would try to win back Silesia, sought assurances from Maria Theresa that this wasn't the case. But when he didn't receive a reply, Frederick, as we've already seen, decided to land the first punch, and on August the 29th, he invaded Saxony. Now, Frederick's overall aim was to replace Austria as the foremost German power, and to achieve this, he planned to occupy Saxony to his southwest, then to move rapidly further south, take the Austrian territory of Bohemia, rest over the winter, and finally advance into Austria itself and take Vienna, thereby ending the war. Nice and simple, and as we've already seen, by the autumn stroke fall of 1756, the first part of this three-part strategy had been successfully achieved. Saxony had been occupied, and Augustus III had been taken prisoner, although shortly afterwards Frederick would release him and Augustus would slink off to Poland. However, stage two of the plan, the occupation of Bohemia and the hoped-for overwintering in Prague, did not go so well. And that's because Austria had in the meantime raised an army of its own that was now threatening its former and Prussian-occupied territory of Silesia. And to counter this, Frederick had to divert some of his forces away from their main aim, which meant spending the winter in Saxony rather than Bohemia. Incidentally, it's interesting to note that none of this pre-war alliance rejigging or the first stages of the war itself had made Hanover, Great Britain's German electorate, any safer, as now it was under threat from France stroke Austria. To counter this and provide assistance to Frederick, George II's government now did two things. First, it sent some much needed money and supplies to its Prussian ally, and secondly, it formed an alliance with several of the smaller Western German states to protect Hanover. London also tried to get the Netherlands to join in, but the Dutch respectfully declined and decided to remain neutral. Two other nations were to join different sides during the Seven Years' War, Portugal on the side of Great Britain and Prussia, and Sweden on the side of France, Austria, and Russia. And finally, it's also interesting to note that even though Great Britain and Russia were now on different sides, they would never actually get to fight against one another. But that was more to do with the geographical distance between the two rather than anything else. Okay, we'll leave things there, I think. Join me next time when we'll be covering the year 1757, a year of widely fluctuating fortunes, which would finally see the Russian army under Field Marshal Stepan Apraksin join the fray. And so until then, dear listeners and patrons, heads down, chins up, look after yourselves, and don't do anything that I wouldn't do. Oh, and I nearly forgot, stay safe.
A new year is full of surprises, but one thing is always predictable. Postage costs go up. Stamps.com gives you crazy discounts of up to 89% off USPS and UPS services. So when postage goes up, your business will barely notice the change. Stamps.com is like your own personal post office, wherever you are. You can even take care of orders on the go with the mobile app. No lines, no traffic, no waiting. Schedule package pickups, automatically find the cheapest and fastest shipping options, and seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. There's even a supply store where you can stock up on mailing supplies, labels, even printers. Stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses just like yours. All you need is a computer or phone and printer. Take a chunk out of your mailing and shipping costs this year with Stamps.com. Sign up with promo code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com code PROGRAM.